Chris?
Oh, my name's Chris and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chris.
Hi. That was unexpected. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a primary alcoholic. I started drinking at 14. I was diagnosed an alcoholic 6 years later. And introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous through Langton Clinic. And like one of the speakers tonight, that was about 19 or 20 years ago. Unlike that speaker, I wasn't all that impressed with you members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was more impressed with the hospital I was in, you know. Male and female patients, a few of those patients, I'm a bit nervous tonight. They worry me a bit, microphones, but, you know, a few of those patients had been exposed to AA, and they told me that they were alcoholics, and I identify with these people, you know. And but I wasn't impressed, as I say, with AA. My first meeting, I was more interested in making a quit at the trots, you know. The patients were Parkinson back their bets. But the next meeting at Ramsgate, every speaker that night talked about the makeup of the alcoholic, and I identified very, very strongly. But I was a bit different, and the difference being that I hang around AA for 8 years as an observer. I believe, looking back, I try to convince you people I should be here, you know. There was times in this eight-year twilight period that I had to come to AA when I was in these sorts of places. But there was the other times, you know, when I was in the fits of despair and I'd crawl into a meeting like a mangy dog. And I never ever declared myself an alcoholic, and I was very anonymous. I'd park a company car 3 blocks away, and all you knew about me was my name was Bruce, and I lived down the block a couple of blocks, you know. And that was the way it was. And you know, I used to leave these meetings as an observer, and on my way back to the pub or the club, I'd start to say my story to myself, you know, like I was imitating an AA speaker. My name was Bruce, and I left home at 14. I ended up shacked up here, there, and everywhere, and this doctor said so-and-so, and the mother-in-law, the prospective mother-in-law said something else. And I'd get up to the latest tale away, whether it was a hospitalisation or a suicidal attempt or whatever it was. And I'd say, you know, those bastards wouldn't understand, you know. And the madness of today, you know, how could I possibly expect you to understand? I hadn't told you, you know. And this is the way it was, you know. But many things kept me back, coming back to this eight-year period. The hope that was generated at these meetings, the things they told me from the floor of a meeting, because I had no chance before or after a meeting because I wasn't here. But from the floor of the meeting, they told me that if I was an alcoholic, if I kept coming long enough, I'd hear my story told. And if I didn't get AA, maybe AA'd get me. And on one occasion, I took a seizure at a meeting at Newtown, you know, and I was carted off to an alcoholic hospital. And an AA member paid the first week in advance. And I never found that out to many years later. But this is the way it was for me. So for that 8 years, about the only thing I could, you know, you could say was that I kept coming, you know. And I eventually joined AA, you know, and it was about 12 or 13 years ago. I got off the grog for 27 months, went to meetings nightly, and all I was sharing for that 27 months in AA was experiences. And to do that, I had to be bombed out on Valium. And Valium was a dirty word in those days, but I felt justified in taking these things because I was told I'd need them for the rest of my life. And I'd take these Valium, you know, before a meeting, and then I'd take a couple during the meeting if I, you know, hadn't been asked to speak. And at the end of the meeting, I'd take a couple more so I wouldn't job the chairman, you know. And I was mad, you know. And the meetings weren't long enough, you know. I was still running from life. I was running from the past. I was running from me. And, you know, my mind used to race at 100 mile an hour, and, you know, about 20 past nine, I started to get a bit of calmness. And then, good night, nurse, see you tomorrow night. And I had to worry about not picking up a drink for 22 and a half hours. Again, looking back for that first 27 months of so-called membership of AA, I believe I was going to meetings because I was frightened I was going to drink on the way home. And I mentioned this one night, and one of the old timers said, you know, you won't have a compulsion till you pick the next one out. Well, I don't know what I had, whether it was a burning obsession, desire, but I had it, you know. And this is the way it was. And eventually, after 27 months of being misunderstood in AA, it says in the big book, you know, to keep what you've got to give it away. And I thought I had heaps to give, and I thought there must be somebody out there like me. And I got involved in a bit of social work, and I went in there with the right reasons, and you know, the madness, you know, I mean, how could I help somebody else if I couldn't help my bloody self, you know? And this particular night in question, I knew if I didn't talk to somebody at gut level, I would drink. And AA had said, whatever you do, don't drink. And it was rather ironic this particular night that I'd done part of the fifth step with the girl I was working with. And, you know, and to me, that was the first highlight of my association in AA, because for other alcoholics, it must be different, or is different, but the sort of like I was, you know. I found it very, very hard to trust, you know, and over the years, many people tried to get the clues on what made me tick, but all to no avail, you know. And this particular night, as I say, I'd done part of the fifth step, and over the next couple of weeks, I told this person my whole life story from go to work. And then I got a bit worried, and I took her out, and we got married a couple of weeks later. And I'm not playing to the crowd, you know, there's people here that know this is true, you know. And, you know, I thought, well, that's the answer, you know. But it wasn't, because I drank again, and the madness was back. And the first 4 months I was married, I was in and out of AA like a yo-yo, and there was hospitalisations, and I'm not being dramatic, I believe, well, I know I play my story down from the floor of a meeting, but the only way by this stage that I could get off the piss was to be hospitalised, and there was at least 4 hospitalisations in the next 12 months, and you know, I ended up at the Army Insane at Lidcombe, and it's about nine years ago, and I choose to believe I've been fed income in AA since then, you know. It was a total of 20 hospitalisations for alcoholism, which is no record, but it was enough for me. And I reached a stage where I had to get up or die, and I'd heard that expression over the years in AA, and I used to think to myself, you know, that's bunging it on a bit, and it's rather dramatic. But that's the way it was when I hit the arm in Soma Lidcombe. The ha-ha was gone, you know, and the psychologist there told me everything that you people had tried to tell me, you know, for so many years. You know, he told me that AA was the only answer. He told me I'd have to get back to it. He told me many things. Now, he said that if I was fed income, I'd only have to go through withdrawal once. And, you know, there was many other things he told me. And every argument I put up with this guy why I couldn't make it in AA, you know, like I've been around so long and I've failed so often, and this bastard upset me and somebody else said something else, you know. Whatever it was, you know, he just shot me down in flames. And I got introduced myself the first time in my life. And as I said earlier, you know, I choose to believe I've been fed income in AA. Along the way, I got out of there, I got back to AA, got back to the workforce, got back to the wife, and we got transferred up to Port Macquarie. And my world fell apart up there. I found that I missed the get-up-or-die city attitude of AA, and, you know, and I felt that I was being taken on face value. You know, you members in Port Macquarie, you know, you're only taking on face value. You know, you hadn't seen me in full flight. And, you know, and I was running to Sydney of a weekend. Thank Christ it was a company car, you know, because I was doing miles and miles, you know, and trying to regain this so-called serenity or calmness or whatever I had at that time. And, you know, but I still wasn't basically honest, you know. I was still thinking the same as I was, and I hadn't cleaned house, I hadn't done anything, you know. And anyhow, I picked up another drink. I found that my drinking changed. I found that I just couldn't get out of the house, and this surprised me because even though basically I'm a loner, I've, up to this stage, I had to at least see faces and hear voices, you know, and crawl into a pub or a club like a mangy dog. But I ended up, you know, drinking at home, and, you know, the wife had shot through, and the local members rallied around and tried to get me back to AA. Relations from Sydney and AA, you know, that I found that I had, they come up, and no way could I make a comeback. And I was just drinking myself out. And one of my many stages, you know, I started corresponding overseas many years ago as a loaner sponsor. And then I reversed the roles and I started to write to these loaner sponsors for help myself, you know, but they used to send tapes of American speakers, you know. And I never ever played these damn things, and I'd stop writing to these bloody people there because they were too straight for me, you know. You know, if I was going through self-pity or anything, they'd tell me to pull myself together. And, you know, so I put a few of these tapes on that I'd acquired over the years, you know, and these speakers talk for an hour and a half, and I'm not going to try and talk that long tonight, but they talk about their childhood, they talk about their active alcoholism, and they talk about the recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. And to me, they also talk a lot more about the emotional side of this disease. And listening to these speakers for an hour and a half, I was going one better than that. I'd put a blank into the cassette and play my story into it, and that's why I'm a bit nervous of mics tonight. And then I was playing myself back at myself and adjudicating on what I said, you know. And I'm my own worst critic at the best of times, you know. But, you know, I was listening to myself, poor little Brizzy boy, you know. I cut my wrist before I got into Bedrick Hospital. It was the third time in Lincoln Clinic before I graduated to Hyderabad. And what year was it in that I got the Wisteria House, you know. And this was a sort of the madness, you know. And over and over to myself again, I was playing myself, you know. And something that Minogue told me many years ago at Hyderabad, you know, he suggested I get out in the scrub and find myself, and I'd had a lot of walkabouts, and so I'd had a couple of so-called sober trips in AA all out the back blocks of Queensland when I was bombed out on Valium, and I'd stayed with lone members, and I made this pilgrimage to make a comeback to AA, and I'd get to these one-horse towns, and you know, I'd talk myself out of going in, oh, no, she wouldn't be interested, or, you know, he'd be sick of me, or, you know, and all the rest of it. And so I was working my way back to Port Macquarie, but through a chain of circumstance, I fell into a meeting a little over 7 years ago now at Crow's Nest, and since that night I've been told in AA I've changed, you know. And today I know this to be true, because along the way in the last 7 and a bit years, Alcoholics Anonymous has proved to me that I don't have to drink. You know, it's released me of this obsession, compulsion and desire to drink. It hasn't made me a saint. You know, the only reason I don't throw lawnmowers around is I haven't got a lawnmower, you know. But, it wasn't easy. I 6 months sober the last time, and again I was, you know, keeping myself together. I found it very hard to trust and talk at gut level. And I was basically doing it on my own, and, a woman member at Warhope suggested I told her I was doing a bit of an AA trip, you know. And she said, call in and see so-and-so in Canberra and give her this message or give her this note or somebody. And I got down to Canberra, and I'd met this woman once before in Canberra at a convention up at Port Macquarie, and I drove around the block for about 3 or 4 times, and I thought, well, eventually I thought, well, I'll go in, and if she asked me very nicely, I'll stay for 10 minutes for a cup of tea, you know. And I ended up staying 4 days and 4 nights, and she became my sponsor, and I only found out yesterday she died. But, she was a great help to me, and, I'm not putting it up on a pedestal, but having got the help from this particular woman in Alcoholics Anonymous 6.5 years ago, I find in my case now, today, I can talk to certain people in AA at gut level, and this has been proved good for me, and I can only say how alcoholism, you know, affected me, and how I've learned through Alcoholics Anonymous. I tried to do the fifth step about 13 years ago in AA, and this particular night in question, I wasn't actually a member at the time, but I was at a meeting at Newtown, and everyone was talking about, get calm, this peace of mind, do the fifth step. And I speared this bloke after the meeting, and I said, I want to do the fifth step with you now. And he knocked me a dack. He said, no, he said, if I drink tomorrow, he said, you might drink too. Now, whether he's right or wrong is beside the point, but he's still sober today. But I can only say, as I say, how it affects me. And having got this sponsor in Canberra and letting her see me as I really was, I find now that I can talk to other people in AA. And it's been good for me because the sort of guy I am, if I can get myself into a spin, some bastard upsets me, if a bit of the past comes up, if I start to doubt my story, or if I start to feel insecure in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I don't have to go running back to square one when I was 14. I just go back the last time I seen the person that knows me, and we kick on from there. I'm making progress in other areas. As I tried to say earlier, for a long time in AA, I was flat out sharing experiences. Tonight, I believe at times I can share a certain amount of strength and hope. Apart from sharing this, I'd like to share the time, and thanks for listening.
Thank you very much. Faye. Faye?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Faye, and I'm an alcoholic. And I've also been addicted to mood and mind-changing drugs. Well, I started off about the age of 29 with a little bottle with 50 Valium, you know, and I took these Valium for a few years in an alcoholic manner that I didn't realise until now. And then I became addicted to whiskey. And I was on whiskey and pills for many, many years. I knew what it was, you know, to pawn things in and out of pawn shops. I had good jobs. I had an army allotment. I had 3 kids, but I still was in and out of pawn shops. I had blackouts. I was dirty. I wasn't washed. I did everything, I suppose, that a wife and a mother shouldn't do. But all along the line, I found an excuse for Faye. You know, this one made me do this. This one made me do that. And I continued on this way for many, many years, more years than I care to remember. And then eventually I left my husband, or I guess he was glad I left him. And I ended up, I had nothing or nobody in the world but 3 kids. And these kids washed me, fed me, kept me off a riverbank and kept me out of a jail. And one day, by way of the child welfare, I came in contact with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I fell in the door, drunk. You know, and I drank on the next day, and then early the next morning I woke up and I looked at Faye. I looked at a dirty house, an empty fridge, and 3 kids. And I picked up a phone and I called a doctor, and for the first time in my life, I admitted I was an alcoholic and I needed help desperately. And I committed myself to Morisset, and I came off Valium, and I came off whiskey. And today I realise that that little pill I thought was so innocent was far more dangerous to me than any bottle of whiskey. And I came out of Morissette, I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous in Tamworth. I forgot to tell you, I belong to the Tamworth group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And here, for the first time, or I'm saying for the first time in my life, I knew real love, human kindness, and things I'd never, never really had in my life before. People didn't want to con me. They didn't want anything from me. They just wanted to see me get well. And this was a beautiful, beautiful experience for me. And I not only knew this love for me and myself, I knew it for my children. And it was beautiful. And I progressed along in Alcoholics Anonymous. The first job I got when I was sober was pumping petrol, you know, and I was going to put petrol into the wrong end of a Volkswagen one day. That's how mad I was. But I did it. I was so mad. And it was good money, and I had three kids. And then I took on a job as a cook in a private hospital, you know, and I put those two eldest kids through teacher's college, and the youngest one was coming along nice. And then I became something, a man many, many years before had told me in Morissette, and I met this man today, and it was beautiful. And this man spoon-fed me when I was in Morissette, not only with food when I couldn't work, eat. He spoon-fed me with kindness and love, and I didn't realise just what this man did for me. And I have remembered him down the road of Alcoholics Anonymous for many, many days, and today, sitting in this hall, I looked up and I thought I saw a ghost, and I saw this man. And this beautiful man I knew when I looked at him wasn't at peace with himself. And I talked to him afterwards, and it was very, very sad. But it was beautiful to think I met this man again here this weekend. And I know I'm breaking into my story, but I was so happy to meet this person again. But I became involved with somebody. And this man had told me many years before, never react to feelings, react to facts. Alcoholics cannot handle emotions. And through this emotion, I came into contact with drugs again. I got onto a tablet called Largactyl after the death of this person, and I had an involuntary movement of the mouth and tongue that never stopped 24 hours a day for 2 years. And I stayed away from Alcoholics Anonymous. But when I did come back to Alcoholics Anonymous, I came back a different person. No more pride, no more arrogance, nothing. Faye was humble. I was ready for you people, this program, and for God to teach me. And you have done this, and it's a beautiful way of life. I'm very happy to be here this weekend to share with you. It's lovely. I love you all. You people, this program, and God have returned me a mother to three beautiful kids. I can't express my gratitude, but I'm very, very happy. Thank you, and God bless you.
Kevin.
My name's Kevin and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm a member of the group that meets in Sydney at the Mater Hospital on Sunday morning. I don't know. I, like a lot of us, at various stages at meetings, I sit there and think, if I'm called, I'll say this, and if I'm called, I'll say that. I have no wisdom. The only wisdom I have is you people. The only life I have today is you people. You restored my sanity. 3.5 years ago, you restored my physical health. And you restored my spiritual health. After a lifetime of drinking, I was drunk when I was 7. That's the first time I remember being drunk. Like a lot of people, I don't really remember when I picked up my first drink, but it was before I was 7. I drank for the next 36 years through a primary education drinking, a secondary education drinking, and a further education drinking, and through a career that took me seemingly successfully overseas for a number of years drinking, giving me, I thought, a lot of confidence. Alcohol seemed to give me a lot of things. As Bede from Randwick often says, what a confidence trick alcohol is. And it was for me. It was such a rip-off. But as it turns out, it was a rip-off with a silver lining. Because today I have you. And you have me. Which, I don't know, I guess that's pretty good. Because we're all one. I was at a meeting yesterday and unity was spoken about. I don't want to talk about unity within the fellowship now, but this unity that I know we are one, and as we all recover, I recover. And as I recover, we all recover. It was terrific to hear Pat tonight. I love to hear Pat speak because she speaks of the example of another alcoholic to her. And to me, Pat is a great example of wisdom and courage and love. My sponsor. I'm finding it very difficult, obviously. But my sponsor gives me everything. Through the serenity that I have most of the time in my sobriety today, I am able to function as a, for most of the time, a reliable member of society. I found it personally very rewarding to hear the Governor-General speak of the other night of the contribution that we can make to society and that Alcoholics Anonymous does make to society. With my sort of calculating brain, when he was talking about the figures, we come up with a figure of $3.5 million a year in counselling. And that's not to be sneezed at, I think. I just think it's terrific to be able to function again. In the spiritual areas, I find, particularly as with everything else in the program, but particularly in that area, I have to keep it very simple. I've rediscovered a higher power that I was brought up in and that I rejected. I found this power again, or this power has found me, and it's a remarkable experience for me. But if I overcomplicate it, as I have done at various stages, it does not become a remarkable experience. That's all I think I'd like to say tonight, but just thank you.
Clive. Evening, everybody. My name's Clive, and I'm an alcoholic. Well, I think I'm lucky. I can remember what I thought I'd talk about if I got called tonight while I was sitting there. So I'll talk about that. I was last Christmas at my brother's place for the Christmas gathering, and my father's dead. One of my brothers is gone, and my younger brother's a successful, very successful, rich businessman. Divorcee with children, and there were lots of lovely ladies about, and gilded slippers thrown in corners, and hams, and too much food, and too much booze, and lots of dope being smoked. And I thought, what am I doing here? And I received a letter from somebody I had something to do with in AA in London, and it happened to be delivered on Christmas Day, and it was a great letter. And I lied down on the floor as my mother was sitting on the floor, and put my head in the lap, and read this letter. And I think it's, I really don't know, it's got to be at least 30 years since I did that. And for me, that felt exceptionally good. Because every lover I ever had always smelt like my mother, I know that. So there had to be something, you know, there was a smell and a feel and a touch and a homeliness and something that I hadn't experienced for so long. And I'm finding a similar thing here this weekend. I'm finding a similar thing in AA. Because for me, having paid my dues and arrived at AA and got sober overseas, I sort of got it easy in a funny sort of way, because I didn't have to walk round a corner and bump into Fred, who I ripped off last week, or Frida, who I knocked out last month, or whatever. I actually sort of got on a time and space machine and flew back into my past, and that was pretty freaky, because Suddenly I was met at a plane by my younger brother, who I had very loving memories of, and told myself that I was the person I loved most in the world. And through my new eyes, I had to actually look at this person and say, well, gee, that's really my younger brother. That's the guy I grew up with. That's the guy I used to fight with. You know, this is the sort of the person that I knew and lived with until I was 17 years old, and I didn't know him. I'd never seen him before. And I was born at Mascot, and I lived at Mascot, and I walked through Mascot and drove through Mascot, and I'd never been there before. Really, I hadn't. I could get in a car, and I could instinctively know which were one-way streets and which weren't. I had that much of a retentive memory, but basically then I had to look at Australia and Australians and all sorts of things with my new eyes. And I live with my younger brother, who, as I said, is a very successful businessman, in his flat, with his friends, eating his food, driving his car on his time. And I tried desperately to educate this man into understanding me. It didn't work, you see. All he could do is accept me, because as far as he's concerned, I'm still a nut. You know, I'm still a Martian. He's still somebody who did all those insane, freaky things which he just doesn't understand. You know, I think he wasn't even born young, but I think I'd never been old, you know, in a funny sort of 2.5-year-old way, and we really are quite different. He is my family of the blood, but he's not my family of the heart, you see, because I could stand up here and talk and not even finish the sentence, and I'm pretty sure that 98% of the people in the room would understand what I'm talking about. And that's fantastic. That really is fantastic. It's that same feeling I got when I lie down on the floor and put my head in my mother's lap. And Pat talked about the search. Well, for me again, it was a search also. I turned over lots of rocks and lots of people and lots of countries and lots of situations, and mine was a long search. And I found what I was looking for. In a way, I was successful. All my failure, if you like, or all my programming for not being successful, all my refusal to accept the responsibility of succeeding, got me here. And so in a way I was successful. In a way I found what I was searching for. And if I did find what I was searching for, and I'm quite sure I did, you know, there's no reason for me to hold back. There's no reason for me to be afraid. But, you know, I still suffer from this ego disease, so at times I'm reticent, and at times I suffer a little bit less and a little bit less all the time. I am getting remarkably better. I'm even at times proud of myself. I think I like myself to a great degree, much more than I did. I'm finding that the best thing that ever happened to me was accepting the responsibility of me. You know, I am responsible for how I feel, and I am responsible for my health and stuff like that. Mental as well as physical, you know, so therefore I have to sort of live up to that. And there's an old man, I could tell you a drunkologue too, but I'd rather not. I'd rather share a couple of exciting things which happened to me, and it was a very old man who was talking about painting pictures actually, but it goes for other things, and he said, responsibility without freedom is slavery. And slavery without, you know, freedom without responsibility is anarchy. So, for me, I find that the answer to what I want is, I still think like is balance. I find I still think totally in absolutes like a child. You know, if it's white and it doesn't look great white, then I'll think totally opposite, painted black. You know, what I need is a balance, and to live in the minute and the now. And for me, it works that way. I think the thing that I was searching for all that time, besides something spiritual, was freedom. I really do. I think that's why I rejected authority and all sorts of things on all state. And I find that I am forced to acknowledge now that I am given total freedom by AA. My problem is how to use it and how to pick it up, and how to be responsible enough towards myself. You see, I'm my own most enemy. I am the battleground. And I'm the one that buggers it up every single time, because I'm the one that keeps expecting things of me. You know, I'm not a superstar. I'm just an alcoholic. And I have to try and keep it simple, and that is difficult. All I can do is say thank you very much for releasing me of the prison of myself on a lot of fronts. And I am very proud to be here. Thank you. Would you like a pen?
Oh. Good evening, everybody. I'm Aileen and I'm an alcoholic. And I come from the Manning area. I say the Manning area because we've got such a lot of meetings in the Foster Town Curry groups, and Tari groups. I need this meeting tonight. Oh God, how I needed it. I haven't been very happy at the convention, really, but I am now. I've got a great deal of serenity since I sat in and listened to other people's experiences. My story runs back to front. I was first taken to AA before I even had picked up a drink by a very dear friend who came from the Newcastle area and who died just a few months after I got into AA through alcoholism. And I had known quite a lot of the wonderful things that could happen to people, and I saw what happened to Frank and how wonderful he was in AA, and yet it didn't stop me from picking up a drink because I firmly believed that God had this plan in mind for me, to know that, you know, that I should go through this hell, this private hell, and come out a better person. And so I hung around AA. This happened in 1960, and I hung around AA for such a long time. And I was going because my husband, that I was married to then, the father of my children, was a very bad drinker, a good man, a good worker, and but he liked his booze, and he suffered alcoholic blackouts. Eventually, he suffered a seizure, which took him. And then I was left entirely alone. And I say alone because from my earliest childhood, I came from a family of eight. We didn't have much money, but we didn't lack in love in our family. And then through the war years, the 6 years that he was away, I still lived with my family. And then I formed a family of my own with the help of my husband. And for those years, up to 34 years of marriage, I hadn't been alone. And when he died, I was completely at a loss. And I got around like a chook with its head cut off. And I had a good, comfortable home, but I still wasn't happy and I couldn't live with me. However, as I said, I hung around AA. And I thought I was going because I wanted to know how to live with this man who had this drinking problem. At the same time, I was drinking, but not at the same place as him because I used to get so embarrassed about him. These were the fun years for me. And I was embarrassed because he used to make me feel so bad when I'd go drinking with him. However, through all this time, I still didn't see that it was me that needed AA. I couldn't get him interested, and he died of a seizure suddenly one Good Friday night. And I still hung around AA. I still thought I was going because I had perhaps a son now that was drinking and becoming an alcoholic. But finally it did get to me. I hung around AA so long. It's not funny. I beat the other man that said he hung around for 5 years. I went round for 10. And one night at a meeting at the hospital, something was said and the penny dropped. And I went down, I rang Tom. Could he pick me up? I was so sick I couldn't even ring the NRMA to come and fix the tyre on me little mini. I had the phone in the house, but I couldn't pick it up. I rang Tom. I said, please, would you come and take me to the meeting? And he took me to the meeting. And I got up and I thought I was going to tell them all, you know, and they'd be all surprised that Aileen was an alcoholic, you know. But they'd been praying for me all these years, and they knew. And I know one night that there was an Al-Anon lady there, and she came to me and she said, and I still didn't wake up, that's how befuddled I was. She said, would you like to come to Al-Anon with us, Aileen, or do you think you'd like to be here? And I said, no, this is my place here. It still didn't enter my head that I was the alcoholic. But I've had, I've been lucky. I haven't had to pick up a drink. But I went on for about 18 months, and then it set in. The honeymoon period was over, and I started to get the electric fleas. And, you know, like me, the alcoholic, I had to do it, as I say, cold chook, because we couldn't afford turkey. And I did it all. And I even put the smokes down, but I've taken it up again the last 12 months because I had a rather shattering experience about 12 months ago. And I felt, fortunately, when I came out of the house, I said to my brother-in-law, who's standing there with a tinny in his hand, oh, God, I'd love a drink. And he went up the shed and got me a tin of Coke. And but my girlfriend handed me a smoke. And there I am, still on them. But that'll go down one of these days. I think one thing at a time is enough for me. But I've had my ups and downs in AA, sometimes depressed. But I'm getting a great deal of serenity. And I know it has changed my life. And it is a wonderful way of life. And I'm very, very grateful to be a member of AA. I hear people sometimes say that, you know, that they were born alcoholics. It doesn't matter how you become an alcoholic, but I've heard this said, but I firmly believe alcohol causes alcoholism. And I firmly believe that I had all the tendencies prior to that, because I didn't drink until I was 40. I was brought up in a Salvation Army life at home and taken to Sunday school, and at the time that I did eventually pick up a drink, I was teaching Sunday school and taking my children off to Sunday school and being a good mother. And in defiance, I thought that God was being very cruel to me. And in rebellion, I did go out and pick up a drink. And so I had some fun years, I must admit that. But the disease started to take hold of me. And my life became hell. And I know that after my husband died, my mother, the dear little Salvation Army lady that I love so much, and the young man spoke about the fragrance of his mother. My mother is a little fragrant woman too. And we all love the smell of our mothers. And I know she said to me after my husband's death, but it could have been the cause of Jim's death. And you know, I think that contributed to my, I didn't pick up a drink, but to my regression in AA. For about 8 months I didn't go. I wanted to commit suicide. I thought of all these terrible things. I didn't realise. It took me a long time to come to the point where people were saying that I wasn't guilty. And finally it came home to me that I wasn't guilty. I wasn't responsible for what my husband did. And I shed that guilt. It was only through the teachings from AA, the good advice I got from you dear people, that cleared my self of this terrible thing I had. I had this nice home, as I said, and I used to throw things around the place at night time when I came home so that I could pick them up next morning and make myself do some work. I was in a terrible state mentally. Physically it didn't do much to me. I used to say I didn't go to hospital. I wasn't put into a hospital, and I did. I went in with a, you know, nervous breakdown. Nobody said to me, you know, do you think you ought to get on the program? But eventually, you know, it came to me and I did. And I've never been, my life since then, this happened in 1977, and things changed for me. I was down in Sydney doing geographical, and the man I was involved with was a drinker too, but his boys gave me the most trouble. And I realised that I was getting out of the frying pan into the fire. I would come home to my own home and I would be a mother and a grandmother because I had almost lost my children through this. And I came home and I tried to go back to the club just to play carpet bowls. Somehow or other, the desire for drink had left me before I realised I was just sick of drinking. You know, I really was. I was sick of drinking. And I used to go back and I'd try to play carpet bowls and try to drink a couple of squashes, and I just couldn't enjoy it. So I came home. I remember coming home before I called Tom, and I said to myself, you know, I'll stay in this house, and that's just what I'll do. I'll just stay in this house. I'll exist without anybody, but I couldn't make it without AA, because I knew that there was a place that I could get peace. And I too was brought up with the god of fear. And finally I came to realise it was a god of love. However, you know, with all these wonderful things, and I went on a tour early in that year, and I met a man who wanted to keep travelling around Australia, and he asked me to marry him, and by the end of that year we were married, and we've done some wonderful trips. I'm very grateful to him. I complain about him sometimes. I wonder to myself whether I've done the wrong thing or the right thing. But he doesn't ask me and doesn't put any restrictions on me, and I can go to as many meetings as I like. He keeps a car on the road for me. All I do is put the petrol in it. I don't even put water or air in the tyres or anything like that. But he keeps it on the road for me. And I've got a lot to be grateful for this way, you know. He brought me up to Armidale this weekend, and he's filling in his time revisiting old people and old friends of his and getting his own meals and that sort of thing while I'm enjoying the company of you beautiful people. I've seen too lots of people today that in the last couple of days that I've met before, and realised what a wonderful love and fellowship there is, and how grateful I am to God that he's given me, and AA has given me, this second chance of this wonderful life that I have now. I have my children who rely on me as a babysitter occasionally, something they wouldn't trust me with when I was drinking. And this is something, it's so wonderful. I had a birthday a couple of weeks ago when I turned 60, and I had a dinner party up there at their place, and it was a wonderful time. My son still has a few drinks, but prior to this Christmas 12 months, he came home very, very drunk and started to pick on me. And I was ready to go to a meeting in Wingham. And I know that, you know, just through the very fact that I had learned to hang on to that little bit of serenity, I walked to the door and said, "Don't worry, Jeff. I won't be coming. You won't ever insult me in your house again, because I won't be coming back." And, of course, he wanted to put his arm around me and kiss me. I shrugged him off. I walked out the door with all the pride and dignity I could muster. As soon as I got in the car to drive down to the meeting, I dissolved into tears and fell on the boys' shoulders when I got there. But I knew that they understood me. And since then, my son came down for Christmas that day, a few weeks after, and there hasn't been a word spoken between either of us. But I know that my sobriety and my life in AA has spoiled his drinking just a little, that one day, through the example that perhaps I have shown of the change in me, that he may say, "Well, Mum's got something." And I pray every day and every night for this, because I've only got one son and one daughter, and I love them very much. And but I'm trusted with their wonderful children, and I'm very, very grateful, as I've said before. And my heart's very full, because, as I said, I really needed this meeting tonight. Things hadn't been going. I think I was just overtired. I think, you know, we don't realise how sick we are. But I realise now that this has been a wonderful meeting, and I don't care how long it goes on. But I'm very, very grateful tonight. Thank you very much.
Filling a bill. Thanks, Trevor. Good night, everyone. I'm Bill, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you. I didn't expect this tonight. I've had a couple of goes this weekend, and I've enjoyed the meeting tonight very much. But me, alcoholic. I drank very early, and right from my very first drink, I had no control whatsoever. I didn't know it then. I thought my behaviour was the same as anyone else's. I didn't know that I was any different to anybody else. But I now know, on looking back, that I had no control. The only control that I had in my early drinking was the amount of money I had in my pocket. So I can't take any credit for that. And very quickly, drink took over and directed me where I went, how I behaved and what I did and what have you. And I didn't particularly like what was happening, but I was unable to do anything about it. And I would never have said that right there and then. If anybody had have asked me, could I stop or could I do this, I'd have said, if I wanted to, but I don't want to. However, as time went on, I was to walk off the family property, and I don't know why, but this is the insanity of this sickness, I believe. The rows that I was causing in my parents' home with my brothers and sisters, and I felt a tremendous guilt about this because I knew it was me that was causing these upheavals in the family circle, and I was unable to do anything about it. So I decided I would leave home, and I did this on many occasions, and my father, in his sincerity to try and help me, would bring me back into the family circle and take up my position on the property again. But there was always one condition, that I didn't drink, or excessively, and that was impossible. I may do it for a little while, but invariably I would pick up the drink again, and I would go to town with a load of fruit, perhaps on Monday morning, and turn up on Friday. And this is the thought of behaviour. And I was wondering why the old man was getting a bit niggly on me. At the age of 16, though, my youngest brother came home from college once, and I had a cattle dog. And he said to me on this particular occasion, you know, Nugget, he said, if ever you come home sober, that dog would bite you because he wouldn't know you. And that would be pretty right, too, because on every occasion I went to town, I never ever intended to get drunk. I only ever went in to have a couple. I never wanted to get drunk. I just wanted that feeling, that contentment and that comfortable feeling that I had right from my very first drink. But I was never able to maintain that level. I always went that bit further. And I never, ever remember having enough to say that, right, I'll stop now, I'm full enough, I'll go home and go to bed. The only time I had enough was when the pubs closed, or I couldn't get any more, or when I flaked out. So this was the pattern of my life for a good number of years. And we hear a lot about the geographicals in AA, and I went on them all. Every place I was going to go to, every place I went to, it was going to be different. And it was. It was worse. And the trouble I was getting into with the police, and the funny thing, I was only thinking there this afternoon, somebody mentioned about the trouble I had with magistrates. And I always got into trouble with them too, because I was a pretty arrogant sort of a fellow. And I remember once the magistrate in the Orange Court, and that's the town I come from, he knew my family, and he was dressing me down very severely. He was telling me to pull my socks up and that my family, I was making a holy show of them and what have you. And I let him have his little spiel, and when he'd finished, I said, "You can drop dead, you rotten mongrel." And it cost me another three quid. Now, the fine for drunk in those days was 5 bob. Now, 3 quid was a hefty fine. And I always wanted that last say, though. And this was me as an alky. Couldn't keep my big mouth shut, and I got a job to do today, too, I might add. Trevor doesn't know what he's let himself in for. He's given me the mic. But through this excessive drinking, I was to go a lot of places that I didn't want to go, and I did a lot of things that I didn't want to do. And as I know it now, it was all against my will all against my better judgment. And although I lost all this material stuff in the beginning of, or early in my drinking, and my position in the family and what have you, and the love and the family, the brothers and sisters and parents and what have you, the thing that started to go was my dignity, my self-respect. And that was bad. But then after many years of trouble and what have you, I lost hope. And that was when the real trouble started. I just didn't give a damn anymore. I didn't care. I accepted the fact that I was a drunk, and that's the way I was going to die, a drunk. And I was terrified of that fact, that I was going to die somewhere unknown, unwanted, unloved, in the gutter. And this was going to be my existence. And I was to go on like this for quite a while. I did try on many occasions to stop drinking. I took pledges and I took a prohibition order out against myself and all these sorts of things, and nothing to work. Fortunately for me, I was introduced to AA. And I went very well in the city for a period of 12 months, and then I went back to the bush. And there wasn't any AA there. And I cut myself off from the lifeline. And I believed, and I really believed this at the time, that I would never ever drink again. I'd had enough. And I thought, armed with the knowledge that AA had given me, that I'd be able to never pick up another drink. But I did. Because all I'd succeeded in doing, apparently, as I look back on it now, was attack the physical side of my sickness. I didn't worry about the other two sides. And I knew and I believed what I'd heard in AA, that I suffered with this threefold sickness. And anyhow, I drank again, and I was to know a devastation and a remorse and despair in that period of drinking. I never ever want to forget that either, because if I do, I may pick up another drink. I want to remember all that, because that's my safeguard about picking up that first drink. And I really believed that AA hadn't worked for me. It never entered my head that I hadn't worked for AA. I believed, as I'd heard in AA read out this chapter 5, where there were people incapable of being honest with themselves. And I was such a dishonest beggar that I thought this was me, because I had never been honest in my life. Long before ever I picked up the first drink, I wasn't honest. I didn't become dishonest because I drank. I was dishonest before I drank. And I believe today, and I really believe this too, that my life didn't become unmanageable because I drank. My life was unmanageable, and that's why I drank. That's my belief. And I believe that when I threw the towel in, and there's people here in the hall that have heard my story before, but my last drink was at Lake Canobolas at Orange. And I tried to do away with myself. I'd heard about the wet brain. And I really thought that either I'd drink myself into a wet brain or I'll kill myself. And I had this tin of methylated spirits and I drank it. As much as I could, but I don't know how much I drank, and that doesn't matter. But that was the method in my madness, was either to have the wet brain and I wouldn't care, or I was going to kill myself, and either way it didn't matter. But neither of those happened. The wet brain part nearly did, I think, but not quite. I had enough sanity left to know what I had to do, that I had to get back to AA. And at this particular stage, I didn't believed in God. I didn't have any faith in God at any rate. But I did ask for help. And I never want to forget this either. And I did for a long time after I became sober. I asked this God that I didn't believe in, and this is the prayer, and I can remember it today, that I uttered. I'd please God help me. I don't care what it is that I've got to do, but I'll do it. Take my arms and my legs, and I don't care, but I've got to stop drinking to live. And I knew it. and I haven't had a drink from that day till this. And it wasn't such a long while after that that I forgot about that. You know, and I used to buck on that second step. The insanity, I wouldn't have it. And one day after a meeting at Burwood, or one night at least, I'd gotten up and I said about this, and I was sober approximately 3 years at this period, and I said, I can't wear this spiritual side and I can't wear the God angle, you know. And I was just putting on a show as I know it now. And after the meeting was over, a little fellow came over to me. He said, come here, grumble guts. He said, I've heard your story. He said, and I've heard you talk up and talk about that last week you had at Lake Canobbles. He said, and you've got God in your hip pocket. And he said, and you're too bloody stupid to see it. And he was dead set right. And I needed that too. And my approach to AA, as it's been set up here tonight, was all wrong. I did everything back to front. But I had to do it that way to prove that the program was right. And I don't believe, and I really truly don't, as I said here the other morning, I don't believe the program is hard. But overcoming Bill to do the program is hard. There's nothing in that program that's hard. And because I wouldn't be sober here tonight if it was. And I really believe that too. I've been very, very fortunate since I came to AA. God and the fellowship and the friends I've met in AA have been very, very kind to me. In the beginning, they were very tolerant. They put up with my shocking attitude, my arrogance, my goodness. And I don't know how they did. They must have been nearly saints, those early members of AA, to put up with me, but they did, thank God. And I'm here tonight, and I owe it all to AA and the God that I accept. I still don't understand God, but he understands me, and he must have a pretty good sense of humour. You know, he puts up with me, and he must be a very tolerant God too. But thank you for sharing and caring.
Maureen, would you like to speak? Is there any lady members here that like to speak? Irena?
No. Good evening, my name's Irena and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Irena.
Hi. And I'm a member of the Newcastle City Group and I'm sober today. Can you hear me down the back?
Yes.
I'm sober today through the grace of God and the fellowship of AA. And for that I am very grateful. I've already spoken at this convention, at the sponsorship workshop, so I won't say too much. I've been sober a little over 2 years, and last year we went to the Adelaide convention, and Adam was 2 weeks old, and this year he's 1 year and 2 weeks old. And but this year also, my mum and my dad have come along, and that's tremendous for me. Mum's been sober a little over a year, and the blessings that I have received in this fellowship are absolutely wonderful. And I know that if I keep coming here where it's all at, God will see me and you through together. Thanks.
Should I ask the gentleman in the third seat here?
Good night all, my name is Rob and I'm an alcoholic and I'm very grateful to be at this convention. I'm having a terrific time, to be quite honest with you. I think it's marvellous, the planning that's gone into it. I come from Melbourne, I'm from a group in Melbourne, the Murrumbina Group, meet Monday night. I was secretary at Melbourne Tuesday night for a fair while, and I also took on the Murrumbina, but I give the Melbourne one away, and I think I got a little lot more out of Murrumbina sort of, because it had fallen right down. We're trying to build it up again, and we just case along very good now, and I think it's a big thing, this getting involved in AA seems to be the secret, because I know you don't notice yourself change, but I know after I was made secretary at Melbourne, well, no woman, those people saying to me after how I sort of change, you know, get a different outlook on life because you're helping. More than you're not just taking, you're giving too, and that's the main thing. That's what AA is all about, apparently. I don't understand the program fully. I believe in a higher power. I choose to call him God. But I know very well he's got me through a lot of tight spots. Like I started drinking at the age of 15 up in Echuca. It's a country town up in the Murray there. As you probably know, and there's 11 pubs in Echuca, I think it was, and the two across the river. Well, I didn't do... I wasn't a dancer. My sister used to go dance, but I preferred to go to the pub. I could still remember the name of the bloke that I started off drinking with, Tom Buckley. It's one of those towns where there's different families. Well, there was the Buckleys and the Martins and the Victories, like the Martins and the Coys you hear about in America, I suppose. Well, I remember Tom Buckley went over to the Palace Hotel, it was. It was a Richmond pub. It's 31 years ago, I think, now. And he said, I was drinking lemonade. He said, I have a drop of beer in it, well, which I did. Well, by the end of the day, that had changed. I was just having straight beer. I couldn't stand the lemonade in it. I remember we lived across the river at that time. My father cleared out on us when I was a little kid, and my mother took us up to Echuca where her family lived. And I remember they were standing out in the front van of my sister and mother, and I took me home in a taxi, and I got out of the taxi, and I thought I'd better show them I'm all right, you know, so I ran across, went to vault the gate, but I had my foot hooked in the top wire, and down I went. Well, that fast is over, and after that it was, I used to get drunk regularly. I used to get horribly sick from it. I remember my sister, she was a couple of years older than me, and I go home and I'd spear my guts out. She'd say, why don't you give it up, Ralph? You can't drink. I'd say, I'll beat it. I kept drinking till I could beat it. But here it's a progressive disease, and it beats you in the end, like the chap that steered me towards Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember he said to me, he was a big rough Irishman. He said to me, you've got to give up, Ralph. He said, you've got to surrender. Surrender to win. I realise now that's what you got to do, because you can't beat this booze. If you keep going, you must go down. I think a higher power steered me. I got lost my licence once for 6 months after my wife had left me. I started off getting me in the old traps again. I got it back, and I'd sworn off it a bit, but then it wasn't long and I was back in the old routine again. I'd been around the... Started off at McNamara's in Caulfield, and my mate left his car because he didn't want to get... He'd got picked up a couple of times before for drunk driving, so I said, oh, you leave your car and we'll go in mine. I said, all right, there's no worries, because I was drinking light ale, for one thing. So, but that's no different, not if you're... midnight that night, I think it was, I'd left his place in Kilda, only had to go straight up the road. I always go, but I got lost somehow or another, and... A couple of ladies in blue got onto me and took me back to Pran, put the breathalyzer on me, and I was gone again. And this time I lost my license for 2 years when I went to court. But I think it was a shame and disgrace of getting picked up by a couple of women, I suppose, might have had something to do with, but it was my last drink. That was, I remember the date, July the 24th, 1979. I went to my first AA meeting the following Wednesday at St. Vincent's. I'd been to see a union solicitor on the Tuesday night. We got free legal advice at the union office, and it was Peter Redlick, and he said to me, he said, is drink a problem with you, Ralph? I'd showed him a letter from my ex-wife's solicitor. If I continued to take the children to the hotel, I'd be refused access. Also told him about the second time I'd been picked up for drunk driving. I said, no, it's no problem, Peter. If I can't buy it, I brew me own. Which I was. I had a good home brew recipe. I got off a chap at work. By this time, I'd made quite a few gallons of the stuff. I'd also found out that if you put more sugar in the stuff, well, it boosts up the content. You only need a few beers of my home brew and you was gone. But, for that to make doing that, because I was married at, and had a couple of children by this time, of course. It's before my wife left, naturally, and she used to even help me brew it. She'd be cooking up in the kitchen, I'd be boiling the hops up out in the wash house. I had another stave out there. But I'd moved into a house to, I was a bit of a workaholic too, to a certain extent, because, I know when I got married, most people send their wives out to work. I didn't believe in that. It was, probably it was ego too, I guess. No, you don't do it, I do it all. So, even though I was on strike, I'd travel all the way to Cranbourne, working on farms and that, but, it was a bit of a battle and things get you down. But always, didn't matter how hot it was or that, I'd always get stuck into the work and always knew I could have a few beers after work. I'd look forward to that. In fact, my wife got that way. She'd knew very well that she'd have to have a bottle, cold bottle for me when I got home from work, otherwise I'd never hit or anything, but she just knew that it'd fix me up. But I never realised there was anything wrong with my drinking. Even I went to Sydney one stage when I had my 21st in Sydney. I remember my 21st birthday party I had on the side of the railway line in Lidcombe. We got the train driver drunk, they were shunting down below and we got them all full. I don't know whether they got the sack or not, but I know I was horribly sick the next day and nobody had any beer, but somebody had a bottle of sweet sherry. So that sufficed because it was alcohol to me, so I can't say I've never drank plonk because I'm quite sure if I was put to the test, I'd have drank metho too, I suppose, because I never did, I don't think. Though lots of people said my home brew was worse than metho, but that was just their opinion. But I remember the night my wife walked out on me, she was going to a party with some friends of hers around the corner. And I stayed home babysitting. Because they weren't my friends, so the fun thing, they didn't like my home brew. So, they didn't appreciate good beer. So they weren't friends of mine, so, I stayed home minding the kids, and a bit of an argument started with her girlfriend was there. I had a daughter there, we were just taking her off the dummy sort of thing. She was crying, and, Karen put the dummy in back in Suzanne's mouth, and I took it out, and she put it back in, and I said, she doesn't have a dummy, and she went and rang me wife up, and the third time my wife came home and got the kids and went back to mummy. So that was it. The divorce went through, and she moved down Geelong, so that made it very awkward for me. But then once again, that's something, my alcoholic thinking, I think, because I started going... My wife had been baptised at Church of Christ in Oakley, and I saw if she went, I started going down to church myself. I remember when I used to drive my car down there, and the car got pinched one Sunday night from outside the church. When my sister came over to take me shopping that Thursday, and I was in Oakley, and I stuck one of my wife's girlfriends, we're still married at this time, and Pat said, your car get pinched, Ralph. I said, yeah, just as well. I said, I've fix that so-and-so up. She said, what do you mean? I said, I was going up the old man's to get the gun, I'd have blown her bloody head off. And just stupid talk, you know, but next thing I know, that was when my wife took off down to Geelong. So that made it a bit more difficult for me, because I'd had access granted to me by the court for my children, which I had John was 5 and Suzanne was 7 at that time. They're still living down Geelong. But, I say I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous the second time, and I was around 18 months, I think, and I happened to I broke my ankle at work. I was on workers' compensation, and I was going to the gallery and meeting at Flinders Street and meeting at night. I was going to 3 meetings a day, and for some reason, I don't know why, it was just I'd fill in time, I guess, but I loved the meetings, but by this time I got to like Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'd been to 3 meetings on Tuesday and got home from my meeting at Malvern. I say my meeting, the meeting where I was secretary. And the phone was ringing with my sister. And I just had my leg out of the plaster. She said, You comfortable? I said, oh, yeah, I'm relaxed. I had my feet up, foot up, resting it. And she said, oh, I had a... been trying to get on you all day. She said, John's been in the intensive care ward in Geelong Hospital. He got knocked off his bike on his way to school that morning. Well, he was only 10 at the time. And, you know, I was tore straight down to Geelong that night. I didn't have any money, I had no petrol in the car, I still had my car, no lights, but still had my car. So I went and knocked up the old chap next door and got some money off him and tore off down Geelong about 2 o'clock in the morning. I took a chance on the coppers, but I went down there and I was on compo and I spent 3 months down there with my son. And all the time it was shocking, you know, he was in a unconscious all that time. I had a copy of the Serenity Prayer that I'd photosat at work and I put up on the bed there, and that's all that kept me going all that time, because it was a shocking period, you know, because he's a terrific little, he is a terrific little kid. I can't say he was, because he is still in that, still in a coma. The doctors say he won't get out of it. I still got my faith in God that he will recover from it, but he can't talk or walk. And for that to happen to a little boy, well, it's perhaps I feel a bit of guilt about it too, because perhaps I was the cause of him tearing down Geelong and all this, you know, but I've just got to accept the fact that it's happened to him. And it's very difficult now, because my daughter, she's 3 years younger than John. I've got a letter from, I get letters from her regularly, and I ring him up every week, of course, but I've just got to learn to accept this thing that perhaps my son will say like it, but also joined that Headway group now, because that's a self-help group for brain damage victims, and that's doing me a lot of good. Also, I'm a great believer in the spiritual business, because I do believe in God, and I go to this Pentecostal church in Richmond Thursday nights now, and I pray for my son all the time. I joined a prayer group there and they pray at 10 o'clock every night, and it does me good. And but I still stick close to Alcoholics Anonymous. I've got to go to meetings every night of the week now if I can. And I think this convention here is incredible, and I'm starting, I think I'll start planning towards next year up at Surfers Paradises or up Queensland Way anyway. And I know we don't project, but we can plan. You've got to plan these things. I know I've been looking forward to this weekend for quite a while now, and it's turned out even better than I expected. I thank you all very much for sharing and caring. Thanks, Dr.
Bill from Glen Innes.
Night, everybody. My name's Bill, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm from the Glen Innes group, and I know Pilliger Bill put me in for this, and I'll deal with him later. But I didn't mind standing up, really, because there's no doubt about alcoholics, we do everything backwards. I think we're supposed to be getting rid of our tails, humans, but I think I'm growing one. And it gets a bit painful, but I've noticed a couple of days I've been here at this convention that there's a lot of people have been grateful about being able to stand up sober and clean, and it reminds me, I was sitting there and it reminded me of I used to get on the grog for weeks on end, you know, I'd 6 weeks. I can remember one session lasting 6 weeks. And mate and I got on it, and I can remember eating baked beans or something once, I think, in that time. But after a certain time on these long sessions, I used to get I still don't understand it, but I'd start to get an idea that I smelt something terrible, you know. And I've no doubt too sometimes. I suppose a bloke was a bit foxy. You know, I had an aversion to water, you know, both internal and external. But, This was a terrible thing. I'd be there and I'd go out every 10 minutes some days, and I'd have a cold shower. Then another one, you know, a bit later on. I always had this idea how many I had. I still had this smell about me. It used to embarrass me, something terrible. But when I came to AA, I sort of started to think positive, and I know that nowadays when I think I stink, you know, I really stink. And so that's one good thing it's done to me. But I was brought up in a Catholic school, and I too was taught that to fear God. But I'm a bit different. I still fear Him. I know that when I do something wrong, if I'm doing the wrong thing, but when I'm doing the right thing, like being here tonight, well, He's with me and He's a mate. And just to see some of the old friends, like Pilliger and the chaps here tonight that I've known for many years, as proof of that he's here. And old chap I was sitting with, he's gone now, I can call him an old chap, but I haven't seen him for a long time, and many years ago he and I used to be prospectors on the same creek. We were after sapphires. And it was great to sit there with him tonight. I can remember on one occasion, being sapphire miners, of course, we were doing quite well. We used to live on one very small tin of baked beans each a day, and a loaf of bread when we can get it. And we were really doing it hard. But I remember one day I had to go up the creek, and there was a hut up there where another bloke was, and he always doing pretty good. But he had a mate in a hotel in Glen Innes, and he used to bring him out cold fowls. He was a cook, this bloke, and always on the grog, and he'd bring these cold chooks out. And so when I went to him, he said, "Look, could you use if I give you 4 or 5 of these fowls," he said, "do you think you could eat them?" He said, "he's given me too many, they're going rotten," he said. So I grabbed them, of course, and flew up to the old mate. And it's a funny thing, we'd been in AA, both of us, for many years when this happened. So it wasn't grog, but it was just that we weren't doing too good. But I reckon you shouldn't feed, you know, poultry bones to anything, they might stick in their neck. But I remember old George, he cleaned 2 of these up without even filleting them, you know. And but it's wonderful to be. That's the thing with me. I'm terrible grateful to be here and sober tonight, and I thank God and AA that I am. And thanks very much.
There is another meeting due to start here at 10:30, so I don't think we should encroach upon that time. So I think it might be opportune if we finished off now, and gives us a few minutes to wander around and get back here in about 10 minutes' time. But before finishing, it is usual to read out from our big book, section and chapter 5 is usually it, how it works, and I'll do that now. "Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. As some of these we bought, we thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil, until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now.
Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. 1. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6. Were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7. Humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order, I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one amongst us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. A. That we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B. That probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C. That God could and would if he were sought. And I just ask you now if you wouldn't mind joining with me in the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Thank you for sharing. The next meeting starts at 10:30.